Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Back at it here on KMOX. It is the Graybar Sports Open Line. Have you for another hour or so. We'll take you till 8 o'clock this evening. If you want to chime in on anything that we're talking about, you can text in at 314-436-7900 or tweet at me at Matt Pauley on air. Kyle Sixta alongside producing. Have you spent much time watching? I know you were just on a trip. Have you spent much time watching the Olympics?
Yeah, that's what I was doing on the trip a lot, is watching the Olympics.
I know people like joke about me loving streaming services a lot. This is when I'm so happy that I have Peacock, because you can just literally pick any event at any given moment and just watch it in real time.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's a really good thing to have. But I need some help from you on something, because I don't know if I am going about something correctly. All right, so Kyle, let's say you are a basketball fan and your team is up by 2 points, and the team that they're playing has the ball, and a three-point shot goes up at the buzzer. What are you hoping for?
The other team took a three.
Yeah.
You're hoping they miss.
You hope they miss. Okay. So let's say it's a baseball game, and you're up by 3 runs in the ninth inning, and the bases are loaded, and the other team comes up to the plate. What are you hoping for in that situation?
You are hoping they make an out.
Okay. All right. So we are very clear that it is a very normal thing in sports to root against the individuals for the team that your team is playing against.
Absolutely.
Is it appropriate, while watching gymnastics, let's say Simone Biles is in a tight run for the gold medal, is it appropriate in gymnastics to hope for a little trip, hope for a little fall, something like that, for an individual from another country?
I think it feels a little bit more wrong when it's individuals, because they've spent 4 years working for this moment specifically, and it feels wrong to just hope for them to trip or mess up. But that's a tough one. I feel like that's a very fine line.
I'm watching like the all around competition for gymnastics yesterday, where Simone did end up winning the gold medal. And she was a little bit behind early on. She had a little bit of a slip up early on, and then she came back and won it without a problem. And then her teammate was right there. Her teammate ended up coming in third, was hoping for, you know, a first, second place finish for Team USA. So was the girl from Brazil? I can't remember where she was from, but somebody comes on just before Simone. And at this point, the other American was in first place. You got a pretty good idea that Simone was probably with a good performance was going to vault up. But I'm sitting there, and to that individual's credit, they didn't mess up. They had a great run. They finished in second place with the silver. But I got to be honest, I'm watching that. I'm kind of rooting for a slip up. I feel bad about it. I feel bad about it, but it doesn't change my actions. I continued to kind of root against, because I wanted to see the Americans go gold, silver. Gold, silver.
You got to be Team USA all the way. Yeah. So I don't think it's the worst thing in the world to root for your country. And if that means, you know, hoping for a little bit of a slip up, it is what it is. At least that's where I stand.
Well, in a lot of Olympic sports, you're able to, like in swimming, you're not rooting for somebody to have a, unless they're like clearly in the lead and you want them to blow it. But generally speaking, you're not rooting for somebody to falter in that spot. You're just rooting for your athlete from your country to have an incredible run. Same thing with like track and field. But on a sport like gymnastics, it's a little bit different, because there's penalties and things like that.
Exactly. It's a lot easier when it's head-to-head, as opposed to someone scoring or something, like they are performing and you have to actively root against them, as opposed to rooting for whoever you want to root for.
I know we do this thing all the time where we see things that Olympic athletes do and you just go, how? But when, and not just Simone Biles, and she is incredible, but like when it comes to the balance beam, they were joking about this. Hancock and Kelly were in with Ronge and Amy earlier today, and I think Michael Kelly said that John Hancock could not even walk across a balance beam, and I think he can. Like not that John Hancock is the greatest athlete in the history of the world, but I think if his life depended on it, he could walk across a balance beam. So I would have confidence in John Hancock that he could pull that off. But sometimes people do things athletically that you just don't understand. Like if somebody hits a home run, I understand that. somebody hits a three-point shot, I understand that. Even like if somebody hits a half-court shot, I understand that. There's things I understand. I can't do them. They are incredibly, you know, it takes incredible skill to do them. But when a gymnast is standing with the back to the balance beam and does a backflip, so you're not even looking at the balance beam, you're looking in the other direction, and you do a backflip and you land onto the balance beam standing, like, I don't even know how you train for that without impaling yourself a million times over and over and over. That is one of those, that just shows the incredible skill of some of these athletes that they could do something like that. And that's not even like their big finish. That's just how they're getting on the balance beam and then they're going to go do everything else. I am amazed by when we see things like that.
It's absurd. I don't, like you said, I don't know how you train for that. When, like, at what point in your childhood are you like, oh, I can do that, or I have this talent? It's just something that you have to discover because it's just insanity.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it, and it's cool. Do you like watching the gymnastics?
I do.
Yeah. I know it's not like normal like sports that we talk about, but I love the Olympics. I love all the different sports. There's never an Olympic sport that's on that I just have to turn off. I love all of it.
Agreed. I found myself this morning watching Germany and Spain handball. That's how desperate I was getting for some Olympics action.
The table, those guys who play table tennis.
They're crazy.
Oh, ha. Again, that's another, I can kind of understand that one a little bit more. But these people are just incredible. The only one that, like, the only sport in the Olympics that I feel like I could do with a minimal amount of training, and it's not in the Summer Olympics, it's in the Winter Olympics. I feel like if I spent some time dedicating myself to curling, I could do it. I watch that and I say to myself, I think that doesn't take any athleticism. It takes skill. Skill and athleticism, very different things. But I feel like if I dedicated a fair amount of time to curling, I could pull that off. When I lived in Wisconsin, curling was a thing there. And I had friends who would like go to the curling club on a weekly basis. And they always told me, like, hey, if you want to come curl with us, just let me know. And I never did it. And it's one of my regrets because I would have liked to have tried curling.
That does sound fun. I'm uneducated when it comes to curling. Is that kind of just like a glorified shuffleboard? Is that what it is?
It's on ice. Like, it's again, it takes skill. Mm-hmm. You got to keep those things moving and stopping and knocking things out and everything.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's shuffleboard on ice.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good way of putting it.
I think so.
Yeah. All right. So there's your Olympic moment for today. I don't know how gymnasts are able to stand back to the balance beam and do a backwards flip and land cleanly onto the balance beam. I just can't comprehend that whatsoever. We are going to take a break. When we come back, our good friend Nate Gatter is going to join us as we roll on with the Graybar Sports Open Line in just a moment right here on KMOX.
This is the Graybar Sports Open Line.
Those bit swings and he hits a drive. He hits a slammer.
On America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
Back at it here on KMOX. It is a Graybar Sports Open Line. My name is Matt Pauly, taking you till about 8 o'clock this evening on a Friday night edition. I'll tell you what, there's been some good things that have happened that I've been excited about this last week. Cardinals going and getting Eric Fetty and Tommy Pham. That was pretty good for the team. I was excited about that. But I am being completely genuine when I say there was nothing that excited me more than a little bit of news that our good friend Nate Gatter got. And he joins us right now via the guest line. And I'm going to share the news with everybody who has not heard, because this is just the coolest thing in the world. And I love when we get to celebrate friends' achievements. Nate Gatter has been named the lead college football play-by-play broadcaster for Westwood One Sports. This is a big-time national play-by-play job. It's one of the elite play-by-play positions in our country, and I'm so happy for Nate. We've got other things to talk about, but before we get anywhere else, Nate, thanks for coming on, and congratulations on just an amazing, amazing thing for you.
Matt, I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate you saying that. It has been definitely a fun last couple of days for me since the news was public, and honestly, a really fun month or so for me since we finalized everything. You know, Westwood One, to me, is not only is it obviously, as you said, just a great outlet and a great job and all of those things, but that could be true of, you know, there are many great play-by-play jobs out there, including at the national level. Westwood One means a little bit more than that to me because I think it's important for people in my generation and hopefully the generations behind me to take pride and give credence and respect to the value of radio broadcasting at the highest levels. And while I understand that it does not occupy the place in the cultural zeitgeist that perhaps it did 60, 70, 80 years ago, or even 30 years ago for that matter, it is still highly relevant in terms of how Americans consume media. And that's true for Odyssey and for your program and for everything that goes on at KMOX as much as it's true for Westwood One. And I think there is a certain art to doing games on the radio, and nobody, absolutely nobody, does it better than Westwood One, which is about the play-by-play guys. It's about the analysts. It's also about the producers. It's also about the engineers. It's also about the folks who work on the corporate side for them in maintaining the sales and doing all the things it takes to be successful in radio in 2024. They have a tremendous amount of number of great people working there, and it's, in some ways, a company that punches so far above its weight class in the sense of number of employees, especially number of full-time employees, relative to its influence and the both volume and quality of inventory that it produces. And to be associated with that brand really does mean so much to me. You know, the likes of the folks who have come before me at Westwood One or who still work at Westwood One, it's just incredible to be included even in the same paragraph, let alone the same sentence with some of those folks. And so I can't tell you, it's been just almost overwhelming. I feel really, really fortunate to be in this position.
I mean, KMOX has had a long relationship with Westwood One. You think about Jack Buck doing Monday Night Football for all those years. We still have the Monday nights and the Thursday night games that we air some of here at KMOX. When I worked previously in my radio career, I worked for Cumulus Media, which is the parent company of Westwood One. So I had a firsthand look on everything that they do, and everything you just said is right on. So I'm just so happy for you, and I wanted to make sure that got out there from a very public standpoint.
Man, I appreciate you. You know I do. It's been special, and I hope that it's a long and successful relationship. Obviously, one of the things that a lot of play-by-play guys love about Westwood One is that people who are there tend to go on and have very, very successful careers, including if that means leaving Westwood One in part or in whole. But I think, you know, from my standpoint, I would love if this is a relationship that continues in some form or fashion for the next, you know, 50 plus years, for the as long as I'm physically healthy enough to continue broadcasting games. And, you know, to your point, about, I think in some ways we talk about like the broadcaster's broadcaster. I think Westwood One is the broadcaster's broadcasting company as far as sports is concerned. And I think that's evidenced in the talent that they maintain. Even the guys who are not necessarily in my position, guys who not only could but do make a lot more money in much higher profile positions elsewhere. You know, Kevin Harlan doesn't do Monday Night Football after having done a Sunday game for CBS because it pays him the same or more, right? Ian Eagle doesn't do Thursday Night Football because it pays him so much relative to doing the NFL on CBS or the Final Four or the NBA playoffs. Kevin Kugler, same deal now. And Jason Benetti comes back and does the NCAA tournament. Dave Pasch comes back and does the NCAA tournament. Spiro Dedis comes back and does the NCAA tournament. You know, those are all guys who have had bigger roles at Westwood One at one time or another, no longer do, and have maintained a relationship such that they still will do a little bit of NFL or they will do a little bit of college basketball in the NCAA tournament. John Sadak is in that bucket now as well, since he's really taken off and had much deserved success with the Cincinnati Reds and elsewhere on television. And he still maintains some of his Westwood One work. So there are a lot of guys out there who make a lot more elsewhere than they make at Westwood One who come back and do stuff, either continue to maintain some kind of regular relationship doing NFL or come back and just here and there and do things like the NCAA tournament. And it's not for the money. They don't get paid badly. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying they're crying poverty for any of them. But they do it because they love the work and they value the company and its history and what it means to sports broadcasting in this country. And that's what makes it so meaningful to me. To be even a pledge in that fraternity, if you will, is enormously impactful in my career, but also, I mean, something that I feel in my soul, honestly, for risk of overselling it. Like, this is something that I care very, very deeply about, and it really is satisfying in, like, a cosmic, out-of-body way to be part of advancing the brand and maintaining its reputation, its prestige, as long into the future as we can.
Well, since you're now Mr. College Football, let's start with that before we get to a little soccer news. We're less than a month out from the start of the college football season. Some teams will start on the 24th. Most teams will start on the weekend of the 31st. Missouri, preseason number 6 team in the SEC. Georgia, Texas, Alabama, Ole Miss, LSU are the teams that are in front of them. Did the voters get that right, or can Missouri come in a little bit better than that?
I think we can do a little better, but that doesn't necessarily mean the voters got it wrong. Right. I mean, the SEC is so good, so deep. You know, if you look at our Westwood One schedule, it's basically like we're the official radio network of the Big Ten and the SEC, because college football's power is so consolidated now. There are a couple of Mizzou games on the schedule. We'll be in Tuscaloosa to do Missouri and Alabama, and we'll be in Columbia in November to do Oklahoma and Mizzou, which I think is going to be a phenomenal game, renewing an old Big 12 rivalry that OU fans pretend they don't care about, and they pretend badly. I think this is going to be an enormously impactful season for Missouri, because as I see it, the roster is probably comparably talented to last year, but the expectations are now much higher. On the one hand, there was pressure last year because Eli Drinkwitz's seat was relatively hot. Now the seat has cooled. Even if you were to say slip up and win 8 or 9 games this year when the expectations are a bit higher, nobody's going to be talking about firing him at the end of the year. So his job is not on the line. But there's pressure that comes from those expectations. And I think, considering the expanded playoff field to 12, this year feels as close to playoff or bust as I imagine it's possible for a season to feel at Missouri, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
I think the long-term ceiling of Missouri's program is that Eli Drinkwitz gets everything right. They're able to incrementally keep increasing his contract, and they've done a great job with that so far, now paying him $9 million a year. And he can build Missouri the way that Dabo Swinney built Clemson. That's a huge thing. That's not my expectation, but I think that's a reasonable ceiling, a best 10% of scenarios, if you will. A 1 in 10 possibility, a 2 in 10 possibility, whatever it is. I don't think that's out of the question, but this season is integral for that. I think if Missouri is really going to continue this takeoff, and we're seeing it in recruiting now, Missouri is putting together the best recruiting class in its history. Eli Drinkwitz and staff specifically are doing that. For me, I think that that's going to necessitate that Missouri make the playoff this year in order for that momentum to truly continue. Now, could they go 9-3, maybe even 10-2, and still somehow miss the playoffs because of how the math works out, and they're like the number 9, 10, 11 team in the country, and they don't squeak into the top 12 because of the conference champions and having to include a group of 5 team? Maybe, and that would not be a bad season. I'm not saying that. But I do think if Mizzou is going to take the next step into trying to be considered, if not one of the elite, at least one of the B++ tier of those schools that are on the outskirts of the national title conversation year in and year out, I think it has to be the playoff this year.
Last thing for you on City SC. We got the news today that Tim Parker is likely to be traded. A guy who's been a really good player for this team, scored the first ever goal in the history of the club, was among league, coming up almost getting a league honor last year. What's your initial takeaway that somebody who's been such an important part of this team is not going to be around anymore?
I think it's in some ways a monumental moment for the club. Because on the one hand, he has played such an enormous role in the first couple of years of City, and nothing that will happen now takes anything away from that. The first goal scorer in each of the first 2 seasons, the first goal scorer in club history, somebody who has been an emotional and visible leader. I think the fan base has really identified with him, and he's personified a lot of the grit that City want to play with. There's been enormous responsibility placed on his shoulders. On the other hand, it represents exactly what City need to do, which is be unsentimental about finding the next steps forward, because this season has frankly been unacceptable. And I think a lot of people recognize that. And the writing was on the wall when City not only brought in a young center back, but then were in the market for another center back/left back. There was something that maybe that wouldn't impact Parker. But I think the writing was always on the wall that Tim Parker at his salary number with an expiring contract was just not going to be a realistic option for City going forward, that he at his age, at his contract number, was just not providing the value that City need at this point under this roster construction. That doesn't mean he's a bad player, and certainly it does not minimize the impact, the value that he's had on and has provided to St. Louis City. But I think part of becoming a true Major League Sports franchise is making Major League Sports franchise business decisions, even though sometimes those things are emotionally painful.
He is Nate Gatter. He is the lead college football play-by-play broadcaster for Westwood One Sports and the co-host of the St. Louis City Soccer Report right here on KMOX. Nate, always appreciate the time. Congrats again. I'm sure we'll talk very soon.
Appreciate you, sir. Thanks for having me.
All right, there's Nate Gatter joining us on the program. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined on the program. This is going to be a lot of fun. Randy Cox recently wrote a book about the life of Hank Aaron, and especially that one special night becoming the home run champion, home run king. We'll go through a lot of things with Randy Cox in just a moment. This is a Gray Bar Sports Open Line on KMOX. It's Gray Bar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. We're on because the Cardinals played day baseball today. They matched up against the Cubs. They ended up losing that game. Cardinals back at tomorrow afternoon, continuing that series against the Cubs. And, of course, we'll have it right here on at your home for Cardinals baseball, KMOX. Right now, really excited for this conversation. We're going to welcome Randy Cox onto the show, author of the book 7:15 at 50, The Night Henry Aaron Changed Baseball and the World Forever. Randy, thanks for taking some time with us today. How are you?
Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. We were actually in St. Louis 2 weeks ago. We had visited some cities, and we had book signings, and I had a book signing there at the at Busch Stadium at the Baseballism store. We watched the Cardinals and the Cubs play, and unfortunately the Cardinals lost that game, but it was a great experience. I'd never been to Busch Stadium. It was a really great atmosphere, and we got to meet some of the Cardinals fans and really enjoyed sharing our book with them and talking about Henry Aaron and the Braves and the Cardinals and the Cubs. It was a really good experience.
One of the really cool things about this book is not only is it stories and adding context to that night that is such an iconic night in the history of baseball, but there's photos that were taken by you that night that maybe haven't been seen before, really special. Before we even get into the stories, can you share with our listeners what you were doing that night and how these photos found their way to the book?
Well, I had been working at the Valley Times News in Lynette, Alabama, for about a year, and the opportunity came to come to go to this game, and since I was from Atlanta, I definitely wanted to go. I was about 90 miles away, and I said, I'm gonna go this night because he's probably gonna hit it, and that's what happened. I got press passes, photography passes, right behind the Braves dugout, and Hank Aaron was right there in front on deck, so I was able to get a lot of photos of him and, of course, the home run, the aftermath, and we ended up with about 100 pictures. We ran maybe 10 or 20 in the paper the next day or so, and those negatives were given to me when I left that newspaper. So about 2 years ago, after Henry Aaron passed away, I thought, I need to get these things out and see what they look like as far as the print. So we printed them out. The scans turned out really well, and I was able to find a publisher that wanted to put it together as a book. So we did it as an eyewitness account of that night in April, and we ended up with about 70 pictures, which included many pictures from Henry Aaron's earlier career, of course, in Milwaukee, and then back to Milwaukee after he finished with the Braves in 74. So we tried to give it as a chronological step by step, and the earlier home run chase of Aaron trying to chase the ghost of Babe Ruth. And it was just an incredible night that night that anybody that was there is always going to remember where they were at that game.
What was the emotions for you when it happened, when that home run was hit?
Well, I was really, really excited because I had been following Henry Aaron, the Braves, and baseball since I was 7 years old. In 1957, the Braves were won their second World Series. The first World Series was won in 1914 by Boston, but the upstart Braves were in Milwaukee. They had moved there from Boston in the early 50s, and they were playing the New York Yankees. And this was really exciting because there were such great teams, but they were just a study in contrast, the different teams. The Braves were upstarts and just could do about anything on the field. And then the Yankees, of course, had so many great players with Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Yogi Berra. And I was 7 years old, and I was a second grader as a Cub Scout. We were watching the World Series in the afternoon when they used to have afternoon games as Cub Scouts. And I didn't realize it till I did the research, but Henry Aaron was an Eagle Scout. So we were watching an Eagle Scout do his work, and he and Eddie Matthews and the rest of the Braves team came through and won the World Series. So I started following the two teams there, Yankees and Braves, through the years. Of course, the Yankees won the next year, 58. But in 1971, I was studying journalism at Georgia State, which is downtown Atlanta. And I got the opportunity to go to the game in which Henry Aaron was sitting on 599 home runs. They were playing Willie Mays and the Giants, and Aaron got up there, and he hit his 600th home run the night that I was there in 1971. And I got to talk to him after the game and ask him if he was thinking about 715. And he said, well, you know, not really thinking too much about it. I just want to do one home run at a time. So 3 years later, there he is at back in Atlanta, ready to hit his home run that broke Babe Ruth's record. And it was so exciting because I got to see him again and talk to him, take pictures. After the home run, there was a little moment in there where he was by himself, and I went over and I congratulated him and told him he did a great job, and he said thank you. He was so humble. He was such a humble man and just a great humanitarian, and he just set some records, not only the home runs, but RBIs, games played, and he was in 25 All-Star games. So he was just quite an athlete, and a lot of people think that 715th home run was probably the greatest moment in sports, if not just baseball history.
Hey, but it's interesting because there's a lot of great like nuggets and stories. One of the, from a negative standpoint, there was a bit of a controversy with that. There was a feud that long went with the Commissioner Kuhn at the time. Like there's a lot that goes on with that night.
Well, you know, that's true. The whole deal was that they didn't think that you know, the odds were that he probably wasn't going to hit one in the first three games, which were in Cincinnati, and then just have him come home, and then they had a 10-game homestand. But as efficient as...
And especially that one special night, becoming the home run champion, home run king. We'll go through a lot of things with Randy Cox in just a moment. This is a Grey Bar Sports Open Line on KMOX. It's Grey Bar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. We're on because the Cardinals played day baseball today. They matched up against the Cubs. They ended up losing that game. Cardinals back at tomorrow afternoon, continuing that series against the Cubs. And, of course, we'll have it right here on at your home for Cardinals baseball, KMOX. Right now, really excited for this conversation. We're going to welcome Randy Cox onto the show, author of the book 715 at 50, The Night Henry Aaron Changed Baseball and the World Forever. Randy, thanks for taking some time with us today. How are you?
Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. We were actually in St. Louis 2 weeks ago. We had visited some cities, and we had book signings, and I had a book signing there at the at Busch Stadium at the Baseballism store. We watched the Cardinals and the Cubs play, and unfortunately, the Cardinals lost that game, but it was a great experience. I've never been to Busch Stadium. It was a really great atmosphere, and we got to meet some of the Cardinals fans and really enjoyed sharing our book with them and talking about Henry Aaron and the Braves and the Cardinals and the Cubs. It was a really good experience.
One of the really cool things about this book is not only is it stories and adding context to that night that is such an iconic night in the history of baseball, but there's photos that were taken by you that night that maybe haven't been seen before, really special. Before we even get into the stories, can you share with our listeners what you were doing that night and how these photos found their way to the book?
Well, I had been working at the Valley Times News in Lynette, Alabama, for about a year, and the opportunity came to come to go to this game, and since I was from Atlanta, I definitely wanted to go. I was about 90 miles away, and I said, "I'm gonna go this night because he's probably gonna hit it," and that's what happened. I got press passes, photography passes, right behind the Braves dugout, and Hank Aaron was right there in front on deck, so I was able to get a lot of photos of him and, of course, the home run, the aftermath, and we ended up with about 100 pictures. We ran maybe 10 or 20 in the paper the next day or so, and those negatives were given to me when I left that newspaper. So about 2 years ago, after Henry Aaron passed away, I thought, I need to get these things out and see what they look like as far as the print. So we printed them out. The scans turned out really well, and I was able to find a publisher that wanted to put it together as a book. So we did it as an eyewitness account of that night in April, and we ended up with about 70 pictures, which included many pictures from Henry Aaron's earlier career, of course, in Milwaukee, and then back to Milwaukee after he finished with the Braves in 74. So we tried to give it as a chronological step by step, and the earlier home run chase of Aaron trying to chase the ghost of Babe Ruth. And it was just an incredible night that night that anybody that was there is always going to remember where they were at that game.
What was the emotions for you when it happened, when that home run was hit?
Well, I was really, really excited because I had been following Henry Aaron, the Braves, and baseball since I was 7 years old. In 1957, the Braves were won their second World Series. The first World Series was won in 1914 by Boston. But the upstart Braves were in Milwaukee. They had moved there from Boston in the early 50s, and they were playing the New York Yankees. And this was really exciting because there were such great teams, but they were just a study in contrast, the different teams. The Braves were upstarts and just could do about anything on the field. And then the Yankees, of course, had so many great players with Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Yogi Berra. And I was 7 years old, and I was a second grader as a Cub Scout. We were watching the World Series in the afternoon when they used to have afternoon games as Cub Scouts. And I didn't realize it till I did the research, but Henry Aaron was an Eagle Scout. So we were watching an Eagle Scout do his work, and he and Eddie Matthews and the rest of the Braves team came through and won the World Series. So I started following the two teams there, Yankees and Braves, through the years. Of course, the Yankees won the next year, 58. But in 1971, I was studying journalism at Georgia State, which is downtown Atlanta, and I got the opportunity to go to the game in which Henry Aaron was sitting on 599 home runs. They were playing Willie Mays and the Giants, and Aaron got up there, and he hit his 600th home run the night that I was there in 1971. And I got to talk to him after the game and ask him if he was thinking about 715. And he said, well, you know, not really thinking too much about it. I just want to do one home run at a time. So 3 years later, there he is at back in Atlanta, ready to hit his home run that broke Babe Ruth's record. And it was so exciting because I got to see him again and talk to him, take pictures. After the home run, there was a little moment in there where he was by himself, and I went over and I congratulated him and told him he did a great job, and he said thank you. He was so humble. He was such a humble man and just a great humanitarian, and he just set some records, not only the home runs, but RBIs, games played, and he was in 25 All-Star games. So he was just quite an athlete, and a lot of people think that 715th home run was probably the greatest moment in sports, if not just baseball history.
Hey, but it's interesting because there's a lot of great like nuggets and stories. One of the, from a negative standpoint, there was a bit of a controversy with that. There was a feud that long went with the Commissioner Kuhn at the time. Like there's a lot that goes on with that night.
Well, you know, that's true. The whole deal was that they didn't think that, you know, the odds were that he probably wasn't going to hit one in the first three games, which were in Cincinnati. And then just have him come home. And then they had a 10 game homestand. But as efficient as Mr. Aaron was, he tied the record on the first game, the first game of the season. And the Braves were going, oh boy, we need to probably set him out for the next two games. But Bowie Kuhn, Commissioner of Baseball, didn't want that to happen because Aaron had normally played in two out of three games, and he said, you got to play him at least one game. So Eddie Matthews, the manager, said, you know, we'll just go ahead and play him on Sunday. We'll let him sit Saturday. So Sunday he went 0-for-4, and that led up to the next night, Monday night, when he did hit the home run. And Bob Hope, who was the publicity director there in Atlanta, he was hoping maybe he'd wait a little bit, you know, maybe a little anticipation. They could get some more games in, and the attendance would be great. They could have some good attendance. But as efficient as Henry Aaron was, he hit the first pitch that the first swing was his 715th home run, and it was absolutely pandemonium when it happened. Everybody was so excited, and we went on the field and took pictures and talked to him, and they had a ceremony, and that was probably the biggest moment in Atlanta sports history. We didn't have a Major League Baseball team until 66 when the Braves moved down here, and it followed from that the Atlanta Falcons, the football team, the basketball team, the Hawks, and a couple of hockey teams, and it was a great moment that we had here, and it really put Atlanta on the map.
He is Randy Cox, the name of the book, 715 at 50, The Night Henry Aaron Changed Baseball and the World Forever. You're going to love the photos in this book. You're going to love the stories, some of which you probably don't know. You can find the book at Amazon. You can find the book at independent booksellers, Barnes & Noble, wherever you want to go. Randy, thank you so much for taking some time with us. Congratulations on putting together this book. Such an incredible work, and I really appreciate you taking some time with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and just wanted to give a shout out to all those St. Louis fans, and they're really great. I'm glad that I got to meet some of them.
Awesome. Very good. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you, sir.
That is Randy Cox joining us again. The name of the book, 715 at 50, The Night Henry Aaron Changed Baseball and the World Forever. Paperback version of the book available at $17.99 on Amazon. Hardcover, $24.99. Money well spent. Kindle version, $7.99. So I think I think you'll enjoy this good piece of baseball history for sure right here. We're going to take one more break. We will come back and we'll wrap up this edition of the program. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Starting to wrap up this edition of the program. Just a few minutes left. Wanted to do a follow-up on a story that we had. Oh, man, has it been a year? It's been a while, and it was big national news when that Jackie Robinson statue in Wichita was stolen and destroyed, part of a little league in the Wichita, Kansas area that allows kids to come participate in little league baseball basically for nothing. A very small fee is charged. It was like $25 or something for everything. And if kids don't have that money, they're able to just play. It was League 42. We had Bob Lutz on around the time that it happened. Wanted to just follow up with this because they found the people who had done it. And I don't know if thankfully is the right word here, but at the very least, it was not racially motivated when they stole the Jackie Robinson statue. They were trying to steal it to basically melt it down because of what it was made of. Doesn't make it better, obviously, but when it first happened, you thought there might be a racial component to it, which would have made it just that much more vile. Still absolutely horrible. Well, the Kansas man who pled guilty to stealing that statue, he was sentenced earlier today, and he received 15 years in prison for multiple cases. He pleaded guilty in May to theft. That was connected to the disappearance of the statue. It actually happened in January, so not quite a little bit less than a year ago. He had faced more than 19 years, so 15 years actually getting off a little bit easier for him. Prosecutor's office also saying that he was going to be forced, I don't know how he's going to do this, but he's going to be forced to pay $41,500 to that league. There haven't been any other arrests connected to the case. Surveillance video did show others around when it was happening, so that's not completely clear what was going on there. And the other part of this story is the mold for that statue still existed, and they were able to get that statue back and everything, which is really cool. So if you're ever in Wichita, you can go check out the statue for yourself. So they were able to do an exact replica. But good to see that the person who was largely evidently responsible for this, that there are ramifications and to doing something that was just horrible. So wanted to pass that along to you before we get out of here. All right. Cardinals, Cubs, two more games here over the next couple days. Tomorrow afternoon, and then they're going to play Sunday night. But kind of a weird way that this series is put together. You almost never see a series that goes night game, day game, day game, night game. But that's with them playing Sunday Night Baseball. That's the way it's going to work out. Next 2 days, fairly important for this team, leading into a big game coming up on Monday. Kind of stinks for the Cardinals that they lost that off day on Monday, and then the Sunday game got turned into Sunday Night Baseball because they're going to be back for an afternoon game on Monday. But that's neither here nor there. Cardinals, Cubs from Wrigley coming up tomorrow. Kyle Gibson against Jameson Taillon. That's going to be a 1:20 first pitch, meaning our coverage tomorrow afternoon is scheduled to begin at 12:25. Thanks so much for being tuned in to a Graybar Sports Open Line tonight. Thanks to all of my guests, Rob Raines, Nate Gatter, Randy Cox. Really enjoyed the program tonight. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you again coming up tomorrow for Cardinals baseball right here on your home for the Cardinals, KMOX. Kindle version, $7.99. I think you'll enjoy this good piece of baseball history for sure right here. We're going to take one more break. We will come back and we'll wrap up this edition of the program. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Starting to wrap up this edition of the program. Just a few minutes left. Wanted to do a follow-up on a story that we had. Oh, man, has it been a year? It's been a while, and it was big national news when that Jackie Robinson statue in Wichita was stolen and destroyed, part of a little league in the Wichita, Kansas area that allows kids to come participate in little league baseball basically for nothing. A very small fee is charged. It was like $25 or something for everything. And if kids don't have that money, they're able to just play. It was League 42. We had Bob Lutz on around the time that it happened. Wanted to just follow up with this because they found the people who had done it. And I don't know if thankfully is the right word here, but at the very least, it was not racially motivated when they stole the Jackie Robinson statue. They were trying to steal it to basically melt it down because of what it was made of. Doesn't make it better, obviously, but when it first happened, you thought there might be a racial component to it, which would have made it just that much more vile. Still absolutely horrible. Well, the Kansas man who pled guilty to stealing that statue, he was sentenced earlier today, and he received 15 years in prison for multiple cases. He pleaded guilty in May to theft. That was connected to the disappearance of the statue. It actually happened in January, so not quite a little bit less than a year ago. He had faced more than 19 years, so 15 years actually getting off a little bit easier for him. Prosecutor's office also saying that he was going to be forced, I don't know how he's going to do this, but he's going to be forced to pay $41,500 to that league. There haven't been any other arrests connected to the case. Surveillance video did show others around when it was happening, so that's not completely clear what was going on there. And the other part of this story is the mold for that statue still existed, and they were able to get that statue back and everything, which is really cool. So if you're ever in Wichita, you can go check out the statue for yourself. So they were able to do an exact replica. But good to see that the person who was largely evidently responsible for this, that there are ramifications and to doing something that was just horrible. So wanted to pass that along to you before we get out of here. All right. Cardinals, Cubs, two more games here over the next couple days. Tomorrow afternoon, and then they're going to play Sunday night. But kind of a weird way that this series is put together. You almost never see a series that goes night game, day game, day game, night game. But that's with them playing Sunday Night Baseball. That's the way it's going to work out. Next 2 days, fairly important for this team, leading into a big game coming up on Monday. Kind of stinks for the Cardinals that they lost that off day on Monday, and then the Sunday game got turned into Sunday Night Baseball because they're going to be back for an afternoon game on Monday. But that's neither here nor there. Cardinals, Cubs from Wrigley coming up tomorrow. Kyle Gibson against Jameson Taillon. That's going to be a 1:20 first pitch, meaning our coverage tomorrow afternoon is scheduled to begin at 12:25. Thanks so much for being tuned in to a Graybar Sports Open Line tonight. Thanks to all of my guests, Rob Raines, Nate Gatter, Randy Cox. Really enjoyed the program tonight. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you again coming up tomorrow for Cardinals baseball right here on your home for the Cardinals, KMOX.